Good morning, and welcome to Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. I'm your host, Tony Yin. Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio discusses interesting and off-center legal topics that aims to make legal discussions more accessible to you. We strive to stimulate interest and provide information while always being entertaining. This week's show is on adverse possession. Before the interview, we'd like to emphasize that this interview only contains general legal information. None of the discussion should be treated as legal advice. If you have any questions regarding property rights or adverse possession, please seek assistance from a legal professional. When discussing property rights, the metaphor of the bundle of rights is often brought up to explain the complexities of property ownership. The bundle of rights can be imagined as a bundle of sticks, where each stick represents an individual right. The bundle can be separated and reassembled. At any given time, a property owner possesses a set of sticks or rights in relation to the property. Under the bundle of rights metaphor, ownership of land is a much more complex composition than simply acquiring all the rights to a land. A single person can possess several rights in relation to a piece of property, and multiple people can also have rights and not necessarily identical rights to the same piece of property. The bundle of rights of property can be divided through, for example, a real estate investment trust to allow commercial investment into that real property. One concept that is intriguing under the bundle of rights theory is squatting. Squatting represents a non-economic way for people to transfer parts of the bundle of rights. Depending on the applicable laws, a squatter can acquire property rights by simply occupying vacant land for an extended period of time. However, squatters face great instability due to the lack of title and government efforts to remove these informal settlements. Squatting can result in adverse possession. In the common law, which is the legal system of judge-made law used here in Canada, adverse possession is the process by which title to a real property is acquired without compensation. This is done by continuous possession or occupation of the property without necessarily the permission of the property's legal owner. I'm joining us now in the studios to discuss the concept of property and adverse possession as Professor Larissa Katz. She currently holds a Canadian research chair in the private law theory. Prior to joining the Faculty of Law at the University of Toronto in 2013, Professor Katz clerked at the Supreme Court of Canada, worked in litigation at Sullivan and Cromwell, and taught at Queen's University Faculty of Law. And Professor Katz, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Tony. I'm delighted to talk to you about property.
Yes. So, to start off, I think it's safe to say that adverse possession, especially for people not in the legal profession, is a concept that could be difficult to grasp. You talked about this topic in great length in your article, The Moral Paradox of Adverse Possession. Do you mind just going a little bit more in depth and explain to the listeners how adverse possession works in the Canadian common law system? Are there any Canadian or Ontario laws that concern adverse possession?
Yeah, so adverse possession is a feature of common law systems of property around the world, where we find the common law at work. So in England, in the UK, in the US, in Canada, and elsewhere. And adverse possession is a mechanism through which a squatter, someone who has been possessing land for a period of time, is able to acquire better title to that land than the paper title holder, the original owner. So adverse possession is a feature, as I said, of common law systems of property. And it is a feature that has come under a lot of criticism and scrutiny by judges as well as by, just members of the public. There's a sense that there's something sort of unjust about the operation of a law. And adverse possession really operates through the statute of limitations that prevents the original owner from ejecting the squatter after the statutory period of time, usually 10 years, has passed. There's a sense that there's something unjust about that, that if somebody owns land, they should not lose their property rights just in virtue of someone else's having wrongfully taken possession of the land. And so there's a sense that adverse possession requires some extra justification, some additional explanation, or that its application should be limited to cases where its social value is clearer. So I'm thinking here of cases of boundary disputes between neighbors, where there might be, you know, one neighbor who has built a garden shed, you know, 5 centimeters over the property line, and now perhaps would suffer, you know, a disproportionate loss if she were required to dismantle the garden shed in order to, you know, ensure that her uses of her land are only and within the boundaries of her own property rights. So that would be an example where adverse possession seems to do some good. It seems to resolve at a very low cost conflict between neighbors. And, you know, people generally will stomach the use of adverse possession in contexts like that. Where adverse possession, you know, has a bad rap is where we see squatters taking possession of larger tracts of land, not under any illusion about their rights, where they know full well someone else owns the land, and yet they are deliberately setting out to take it over anyway. These are the cases of so-called bad faith adverse possession, where you have an adverse possessor whose mindset is, in effect, hostile to the rights, the property rights of the true owner. And there we see judges have been reluctant to allow adverse possession to run its course. Now, we should bear in mind, to give you a little context, that adverse possession is a common law doctrine. That is to say that it's come out of the common law of property, the judge-made law of property, that has been developed over centuries in, you know, common law countries like the UK and Canada. In many jurisdictions, and in Ontario, for example, in particular, we have statutes, for example, the Land Titles Act, that sharply restricts the applicability of adverse possession in order to prevent people from acquiring new property rights through adverse possession. This is something we can talk about later, but it's a kind of a response to the worries that I flag that people have about adverse possession, that there's a sense that we want property rights to pass from one owner to the next in sanctioned ways through, for example, grant, through sale, through inheritance, but not through these, you know, sort of facts on the ground, you know, sort of hostile takeovers that we see as characteristic of bad faith adverse possession. So the Land Titles Act, which sharply restricts the availability of adverse possession to squatters, ensures or tries to ensure that, you know, the facts on the ground don't win the day. That it's what's on the books, the law on the books, that matters. And Land Titles Acts give priority, of course, to the paper title holder, the person who has registered title in the land title system. So that's a kind of interesting development. We see that, you know, in many jurisdictions that have a common law system of property, we have this overlay of statute that tries to restrict this area of doctrine that I have argued in my own work, nonetheless, has a really important role to play, even in cases where there's bad faith squatters.
So from our discussion right now and from reading your article, you talked about some analogies. One analogy you talked about is comparing adverse possession to land theft, which you mentioned just right now. But another analogy that you brought up in your article, Moral Paradox of Adverse Possession, is that you actually compare it to a revolution, especially of a bloodless coup. Could you just maybe expand this a little bit? What is your reasoning behind this analogy?
Mm-hmm. So when I look at adverse possession, I see the intuitive appeal of thinking of squatters as land thieves, a person who is stealing from another person, the true owner. And the paradox that I think instantly strikes us is the standpoint that the law takes toward the squatter before she has met the statutory requirements of 10 years of adverse possession, and the standpoint of the law after the 10 years passes, which is that this squatter, who before was treated effectively as a thief, now emerges triumphant as the new owner of the land. And how to reconcile the very different standpoints, the before and the after standpoint that the law takes to the squatter who is taking over possession of someone else's land. And, you know, thinking about it a little bit more, I took the view that adverse possession, the way that it operates, reflects something very fundamental and basic about the nature of property. That at its very core, property, the ownership of land, which is of course what we're concerned with here, is a position of authority, the authority to set the agenda for land in a way that regulates the activities of others. And a position of authority backed by law is actually meant to do something for the way that we all relate. It's actually meant to serve the purpose of coordinating our activities, of in fact supplying a framework for the way that we interact with respect to land. So what happens generally, I ask myself, when someone who has authority in principle, has the right to exercise authority, loses the capacity to exercise authority? So what happens if we now move to the public law context? What happens when someone with the right to rule loses the basic de facto capacity to rule, loses the capacity to issue the kind of authoritative pronouncements, for example, that we associate with law that actually regulates or coordinates the interactions of people within a bounded territory? So we have a lot of precedent for thinking about this in history. So then one example that I take up in my article concerns the so-called White Russians who fled Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution and who took up a kind of shadow government in London, England, with the support of the British. And, you know, everybody internationally recognized the right to rule of the White Russians. They recognized that the White Russians had the right to rule, you know, the territory that comprised Russia. But after a certain amount of time had passed, when the Bolshevik Revolution clearly had succeeded, at some point, the loss of de facto authority undermined the possibility of de jure authority by that White Russian shadow government in London. At some point, even though the international community recognized the right to rule and the initial wrongfulness of a revolution, when the dust settled, the very possibility of authority, of effective authority, as opposed to merely theoretical authority, requires also de facto authority, the actual exercise of the authority that a person claims to have the right to. So at some point, it makes no sense to say that the White Russians were making law for the Russian people. No, actually, the Bolsheviks were making law for the Russian people in Russia. And at some point, the same transformation happens in property law. After a sufficient passage of time, 10 years is the period that we have sort of set for ourselves in our law, after 10 years has passed where the true owner has lost control of the position of ownership, has effectively been ousted from the office of ownership, at some point that person no longer has de facto authority. The agenda-setting authority is exercised, in fact, by the squatter.
Well, one thing you talked about there that kind of interests me is that one worry that could be brought up is that although we do now have an owner of property and they can be recognized as wielding that power, can we also have a reason to recognize the average possessor's claim to that authority then? How would you respond to that worry?
So that is a very legitimate worry, right? The idea that the claim to the authority of the adverse possessor is based on nothing more than the de facto taking up of possession. Now, adverse possession is always ruled out possession by force or fraud. So we have this sense that force or fraud cannot be a part of this bloodless coup, right, in a sense. That it is only just through the actual and effective exercise of agenda-setting authority by the squatter that that person comes to be recognized as the person who occupies the office of ownership at the end of the day. We come to recognize that the original owner has, in effect, abdicated the office, is no longer in office, and has been ousted in some sense, but not through force and not through fraud, right? But simply through a failure herself to exercise authority. Now remember, throughout that 10-year period, at any time, the true owner can go to court and get assistance in ejecting the squatter, can herself step up and start to assume the responsibilities of ownership by in fact exercising agenda-setting authority herself. So at any time within the 10-year period, it is open for her to simply fully, in fact, occupy the office of ownership. She's not subject to force or fraud in the ouster. It's her failure to do that for 10 years that leaves, from the point of view of law, no other conclusion than, well, it seems that the office holder here is the squatter, just in virtue of the facts on the ground that we see. Now, the claim of right, so there's something kind of interesting in the law's reaction to our claims of right to property versus our claims of right to a person. So there's no way in which I'm going to forfeit my right to my person. And the way that we see through adverse possession, the true owner forfeiting her right to the office of ownership. And my view is that that has to do with the very nature, the very different nature of the two rights involved. That when in the context of property, we're talking about a kind of office. That is to say, the warrant to make decisions about a matter of shared concern, what can be done with this land around here. Whereas when it comes to my person and my right to my person, that's a truer right, if you like. It's a right that nobody else can stand in the same way that I can. No one else can assume or take up my right to my person. So that there's no sense in which I can forfeit that right through non-use. So this again highlights the very different natures of these two different rights, the right to property on the one hand and the right to the person on the other. And if we start to think about ownership as a kind of office, we can understand why it is that the law looks to whether or not the office is being filled in backstopping and in supporting our claim of right to property rights. So there's a property right, and then there's a right to property rights. I look at the property right as an office, and the right to the office as the claim of title that we have, the claim of right that we have as owners. We can lose that, right? Where someone else has more effectively taken up the position. Now again, it's a very low standard we hold owners to, even in the common law of property. Just maintain some de facto authority here, so that you can be said to actually occupy the office of ownership. Some. Doesn't have to be much. The owner doesn't have to do much to prove that she has retained ownership, right? And to disallow the squatter from establishing that the squatter has exclusive agenda-setting authority.
So linking this concept to another concept that you talk about right here and from another article that you wrote, titled Exclusion and Exclusivity in Property Law, you talked about how when you focus on models of ownership, we should be focusing more on preservation of the owner's position as an exclusive agenda setter for their own thing, rather than focusing on the right of exclusion of all non-owners, for example, squatters, I guess. So how do you think the dynamic between these play together? It seems to me to be a very interesting concept. How do they interact, I guess?
Yeah, great. So exclusion and exclusivity was an article I wrote in 2008. It was actually my first property article when I was a very new academic. And I had this intuition then that property couldn't be fully understood just in terms of the right to exclude along the boundaries of the thing, but had to be understood as the authority, the exclusive authority, to set the agenda within the boundaries of the thing. This view of property, I thought, helped to explain a number of doctrinal puzzles. It also, in my view, helped to explain why adverse possession worked the way that it did. That adverse possession really was trying to flesh out who was effectively the agenda setter with respect to this parcel of land. And so one way in which adverse possession can be understood to really be tracking the effectiveness of agenda setting authority is through the inconsistent use test that we find in some jurisdictions. This is a test that was developed in Canada by Bertha Wilson, Justice Bertha Wilson, when she was on the Court of Appeal. It's a controversial test, I'm going to add right away, so not everyone thinks that it's the right way to understand adverse possession. But this idea of inconsistent use, the test of inconsistent use, is aimed at understanding whether anything that the squatter is doing, whether anything that that squatter is doing as a possessor, is actually inconsistent with the agenda the owner, the paper title holder, the original owner, has set for that land. So if the owner, the original owner, has set an agenda that is in no way in conflict with what the possessor is doing, then the possessor, the adverse possessor, isn't actually really adverse. They're not challenging the authority of the original owner in any meaningful way. By contrast, where the squatter can show that her activities that constitute her possession of that land are inconsistent with the original owner's plans for the land, she can establish that, in fact, she has taken over the agenda-setting function rather than simply slotting in and acting in harmony with the original owner's agenda. So, in a way, this understanding of ownership as exclusive agenda-setting authority allows us to identify the kinds of challenges that are the most fundamental to the very position of ownership itself. The challenges that are the most fundamental are not the boundary crossings that happen all the time, actually, without in any way undermining ownership. The kind of challenge that undermines ownership is a rival agenda setter who sets an agenda that is inconsistent with the original owner's agenda for that very same piece of land.
So you mentioned this inconsistent use test is actually from a Canadian scholar. So I'm just wondering then, in other common law jurisdictions such as US, UK, do they have a different opinion, different point of view about average possession then?
Right.
How they view this topic then?
Yeah, so in fact, you know, without giving the full doctrinal details, there are a number of actually quite different approaches to adverse possession taken in a variety of jurisdictions. So throughout even the USA, for instance, there's at least three different and very distinct approaches to adverse possession. So one approach to adverse possession that we can find in some common law jurisdictions is what I call the good faith approach. This is the approach to adverse possession that allows that an adverse possessor will succeed only where she was acting in good faith to begin with. This would be the example of accepting the effect of adverse possession where there's, for example, a good faith neighbor who oversteps the boundaries of her property rights but didn't really realize she was doing that. And then all adverse possession is doing is, you know, trying to resolve that conflict in a way that doesn't cause a disproportionate loss on either side. You know, then there's a view that is taken actually, I think is probably the view in Ontario today, which is the objective view, which doesn't really want to investigate the bad faith of the squatter or to really concern itself at all with the intentions of either parties, either the intentions of the owner, or the plans the owner had for the thing, or the plans of the adverse possessor, but really just wants to look at whether, as a matter of fact, the squatter acted in such a way as to exclude the true owner. And so really it's on an objective level rather than a deeper level of looking at intention or animus or mindset that we kind of resolve this question of whether or not adverse possession has occurred and has been successful. And then the bad faith, the full-fledged bad faith view of adverse possession is no, we really do want someone who deliberately sets out to be an agenda setter here and who actually is hostile to the rights of the true owner, who actually sets out to take up this position. And the things that she's doing on the land, on the ground, actually are with reference to a very clear plan that she has to, in effect, occupy the office of ownership. And so there's a kind of variety of different ways that courts have gone. Sometimes courts are split. Sometimes they kind of go back and forth because, in fact, people's moral intuitions about adverse possession are really varied and sometimes end up dominating even when the law is pretty clear. So there was a study done many years ago now which looked at jurisdictions that were ostensibly bad faith jurisdictions where in fact the precedent would require, you know, the animus dispossidendi, which is to say the mindset of dispossessing the true owner, but where courts couldn't bring themselves to allow the adverse possessor to succeed where it was very clear they had done this on purpose. Because they just simply couldn't, as a moral matter, side with the land thief. And so moral intuitions about adverse possession have actually always been in play and have sometimes really skewed the way in which adverse possession, the law of adverse possession, has been applied, even where it's relatively clear what it ought to be in that particular jurisdiction.
From our discussion right now, has become, I guess, a little bit more clear to me. When we talk about the moral paradox, at least to me, it seems like we're looking at what's the objective and what is the intention here. And a lot of times these, in different jurisdictions, there's different point of view on this. At least this is how I'm seeing it right now. One thing from your article that I found very interesting is that you talk about how adverse possession could help solve the moral problem of the lawless people. Do you mind just expanding on that a little bit more?
So I have a view about ownership authority that connects it to the idea of legality. That is to say, the idea that there is authority regulating our interactions within certain territorial bounds, not force. And so this, again, is consistent with my general view that property rights are not like other private rights, that these are property rights really are better understood as a kind of position of authority, a kind of office within the legal order that is charged with resolving a certain question of shared concern. How ought we to interact with respect to this thing in our shared environment? And so the way that I understand it, or the function of property within a legal order, is to regulate conflicts with respect to land use on the basis of an authoritative decision, an authoritative agenda. And the absence of authoritative decision-making with respect to an area of land by an owner, whether it's a private owner, a private actor, or whether it's a public actor, the absence of an owner setting the agenda for land throws us into a kind of mini state of nature in that era, in that sort of location. And that it would be, in effect, to deprive us of an authoritative framework if we were not to ensure that there was an owner who was always the authoritative source of decision making with respect to the things in our shared environment. So this view is consistent with the state being the owner of something. The state, in my view, is the owner of last resort, where there's no private actor that can be found to be held responsible for owning something. And it's consistent also with my general view that there can be no res nullius. There can be no unowned things. That there's always going to be someone responsible for agenda setting with respect to a particular thing. Now, because agenda setting authority always concerns particulars, whereas law always concerns generals, general matters as opposed to particular things. So, for example, we don't have laws that are particularly aimed at an individual or a particular one-off thing in the world. Laws are always of general application. But agenda setting authority always concerns particular things in the world. So that kind of authority is always required to complete the legal order, to ensure legality throughout the territorial, the area in which we are all kind of finding ourselves and we're all interacting all the time. So that's the view, is that to leave land agendaless would be, in a way, the equivalent of leaving people lawless. It would mean that we would be depriving people in our interactions as they concern land of an authoritative framework for working out conflicts about use, for working out how we interact, for coordinating with each other.
So I guess I have just one more question.
Sure.
So earlier you talked about how in Ontario there's statutory limitations, and how usually here in Ontario it's a little bit more objectively focused on the use of the land. So I'm just wondering, for everyday person, is this something still that they have to worry about if it's a land that they do not regularly occupy? If they're not there all the time, should they now put up large fences to prevent squatters? Or would you say, you know, there's statutory limitations and, you know, preventions that can help them make sure they keep their land? Is this something that could apply to the everyday person? And for this question, I'm merely seeking legal information and not legal advice. Anything you say, I think the listener should be aware, shouldn't be treated as legal advice.
Excellent question. So in Ontario, most, if not all, land is now registered under the Land Titles Act. And land that is registered under the Land Titles Act, as opposed to land that was simply under the old recording system, that land is protected against new claims of adverse possession. However, the Land Titles Act has an exception for already ripened claims of adverse possession. So if adverse possession has already occurred with respect to land that is then subsequently registered under the Land Titles Act, the claim of the adverse possessor will be valid, even under this new relatively new statutory regime. So do people need to worry about adverse possession? Well, in a way, you don't need to worry about it because it's already happened to you, or it hasn't. No new claims of adverse possession are possible against land that's already registered. So in effect, by ensuring that your land is properly registered under the land title system, as it almost certainly is throughout Ontario today, not so 10 years ago, but today, you've already protected yourself against future claims of adverse possession. The real worry is just the older claims that have already ripened. And this was particularly problematic in cottage country, which was only brought into the land title system, you know, relatively recently. So where we do sometimes find these already ripened claims of adverse possession through long time adverse possession by a squatter. Now, I should also say that depending where your listeners are, you know, in some parts of Canada, for example, in some of the maritime areas, there still is recording system. There still are recording systems rather than land title systems, in which case adverse possession is still alive and well. Throughout the USA, it's still alive and well. There's no land titles in the US. It's all recording systems. So what is the difference between a recording system and a land title system, and why does it matter so much for adverse possession? Well, a land title system is a state-backed guarantee that the register, what's on the register, what's on title, is in fact a good mirror of the property rights that are out there in the world. So the state guarantees that what you read off of the land title itself in fact reflects the rights that are out there in the real world. In a recording system, the record, which indicates who owns what, isn't guaranteed by the state in the same way, right? It's just a fairly good, as an evidentiary matter, as a kind of, you know, just a matter of epistemology, what we can know about the world, is a pretty good record of what the state of property rights really are with respect to any particular tract of land. But it's up to each one of us as private actors to do our own research and hire lawyers to figure out whether or not the title is exactly what it seems to be based on the records. So the recording system versus the land title system really splits on whether the state guarantees the accuracy of the register or whether it doesn't, right? And adverse possession is a feature of a recording system precisely because, in fact, property rights are administered in a kind of decentralized way by each one of us as owners or prospective buyers of land, subject to being, you know, subject to property rights changing hands through things like adverse possession. It's a much more decentralized system, whereas land title system is much more centralized, tops down, versus the decentralized bottoms up that characterized the old common law recording system of property.
Right. Well, that's all my questions today. Do you think that there are any areas of concern or interest that we have yet to bring up in terms of adverse possession or property law in general that you want to discuss?
Well, let me just leave your readers with a puzzle. And I know we don't have time to get into it in great detail now. But one of the most interesting puzzles for students and scholars of property law is why adverse possession didn't take hold in the same way with respect to chattel, that is to say, personal property, goods, movables. Why just land? And this is a really interesting question because, of course, some of the dominant theories of adverse possession, which would concern, you know, adverse possession's, you know, function in resolving problems of lost evidence and so on, might be just as applicable when it comes to chattel or goods as to land. So that's a really interesting puzzle. I think it has to do with the salience of land and a system of property that is organized as a system of authority. But it's a neat puzzle and it's worth further thought.
For sure, for sure. That's something I'll be thinking about for the next little while, for sure. But Professor Kat, thank you so much for taking the time to join us in a discussion on property laws. It's been extremely delightful to listen and hear your point of view regarding these issues. Once again, I'd like to thank you for joining us today on Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. And to all the listeners out there, thank you all for tuning in. Before we end the show today, we would like to say that the views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, hosts, or the Queen's University Faculty of Law. Today's show was produced by me, Tony Yin. I am your host, Tony Yin. If you like this interview, you can find more on the Queen's Pro Bono Radio website.